Hey, it's Justin Harvey. Thanks for tuning in to the Anesthesia and Pain Management Success Podcast. With APM Success, we take a close look at important topics pertaining to business, practice management, personal finance, and careers for anesthesiologists and pain management physicians. We work hard to take your critical questions straight to the experts. Thanks for listening. Hello, and welcome to episode 132 of APM Success. We are getting down to the wire on tax season. So if you're within the sound of my voice and you don't already have a tax preparer, I would suggest that you find someone to do your taxes as soon as possible. We're currently helping our last few straggling clients get linked up with a trusted CPA. And if you're one of those folks who's been doing your backdoor Roth IRA, here's your friendly reminder that TurboTax does not really like Form 8606 in my experience, meaning if you're doing a backdoor Roth IRA contribution, you're putting money into your traditional, it's a non-deductible contribution, so you're not being taxed when you convert it into a Roth IRA, and then you move into the Roth IRA to get that money into a tax-free account. When you do all that, it requires that you fill out the Form 8606 on your tax return. TurboTax is great at a lot of things, but capturing this properly is not one of them. And so you might find yourself banging your head against the wall, paying an extra couple grand in taxes and trying to find someone to help you on the 1-800-TURBOTAX helpline if you are self-preparing and doing a backdoor Roth. So just a word of caution, make sure you keep an eye out for that. In addition, I would remind you that sometimes CPAs don't actually properly handle this either. So make sure you review your 8606 and or the 1040 to see that your IRA contributions and distributions are handled properly. This can be a very expensive mistake if not. Today, I want to talk about a question. I was recently doing a lecture for an anesthesia department, actually, and one of the questions that came up in the Q&A was one that I thought would make for good fodder in a monologue here. And it had to do with the right timing for buying a house, the right amount, any factors that would influence whether or not someone should purchase a home, particularly as it relates to career decisions, moving for residency and or fellowship, moving to take an attending role, and all the personal factors that go into that. And so this is one of these highly personalized questions that the answers can be two totally different answers for two physicians, depending on your life circumstances. But I tend to look at a question like this by thinking about the idea of what I call stress-adjusted wealth, meaning the point of life is not to, as I tell people, die on the biggest amount of $100 bills possible, but rather to use your wealth to serve whatever you want, to get out of life, to give your family the best life possible, to express generosity and create culture in your life amongst your kids that are going to prepare them for the world, and to travel in the ways that are important, and to support organizations that you want to. That's the point of wealth. And if you stress yourself out and work really, really, really hard to get the maximum amount of money, but not an optimal amount of money, then that's not what I would suggest you do with your time. And so bringing this idea of stress-adjusted wealth to bear in the conversation for should I buy a home right now? Think about it in the context of what is the economic upside or downside and how much stress is being introduced based on where you're at in your life. So, you know, residency is one time where you're moving for a predetermined period of time, 3, 4, 5 years, maybe if you append a fellowship there as well, could be longer. And there's a beginning point and an end point. And in particular, in circumstances where you're moving to a place where you don't intend to stay, this is a useful case study to think about the pros and cons. The reasons that someone might want to do this, and I do occasionally have, you know, meds like MS4 saying, hey, I want to buy a house. I'm a real go-getter. I want to, you know, I hate the idea of throwing away money on rent, which I want to dispel that myth, throwing away money on rent. We're going to address that. But I want to, you know, buy a place and enjoy market appreciation and then sell it and make money when I leave town. And that can work. If you own a house, the market moves up over time. Good for you. You can sell it. You can make money. You can also make the space your own. And in particular, if you have a family, if you're moving with a spouse and or kids, it can be significantly, you know, it's just more like emotionally fulfilling to have a space that you own and you can paint the walls whatever color you want to. You can build that man cave if you want to in between your Q3 call shifts or whatever. And that can be something that's has significant benefit besides just the financial benefit. On the downside, you might not actually get the market appreciation you're looking for, meaning the market could move against you. If you bought a house in 2006 when you moved for residency, by the time you sold it in 2010, you probably lost a lot of money. In addition, you've got to deal with all the maintenance issues. And, you know, I don't need to go into a lot of those obvious types of things. One thing I will say is if you're moving to a place from afar and you're not sure, you're taking an attending role, you're not sure if it's going to work out, you don't have, you know, it's not like you have you and your spouse has their entire family centered in one area and you're trying out an area, but you're not positive it's the last place you're ever going to live, then that purchase, especially if it's an expensive one, can be a real ball and chain and a problem for negotiating down the line. Meaning if you've got $1.5 million asset and you're trying to renegotiate a job contract that isn't working out, or you're trying to, you know, maybe because of a non-compete, you have to leave town. This is not uncommon right now, although the winds of change are blowing. And I think contracts and even the enforcement of contracts and of non-competes is getting a little bit more friendly to employees. Having a mortgage payment that you have to keep on paying even if you leave can be a huge, well, sticking point. And sometimes you got to sell at a loss. Sometimes you've got to risk being a long-distance landlord if you own that house. And it's much easier to just, you know, terminate a lease or perhaps just let a lease run out in order to move again and take a different job that is a better fit for you. So all this is to say, you know, what is the minimum amount of time that you should consider living in an area before buying makes sense? It really does depend. But I usually tell people 5 years is kind of the rule of thumb. If it's going to be longer than 5 years, if you have a reasonable expectation of being in a certain geographic locale for 5 years or more, then I could argue that buying would make sense. And this is because over time, real estate markets in general tend to appreciate, well, I should say anything that's a tangible asset that's dollar denominated does go up over time just because of inflation. Now, there's significant geographic disparity in terms of what real estate markets do over time. And sometimes they're flat, sometimes they're down. But the longer the time horizon is, the more likely it is that you're at least not going to lose money. And then a lot of the emotional and psychological benefits can outweigh any economic downside, and it makes sense to just buy the house if you're going to be there for 5 years or more. One of the important factors to understand as it relates to this, how long can I live somewhere before it makes sense to buy, is illustrated by looking at a quick case study and a specific tool that I often reference. So this came up with a client the other day. They're in the Bay Area. They're currently paying $5,500 for a nice apartment. They don't like the idea of quote unquote throwing away money on rent. And so they said, Justin, we want to consider buying and we're looking at a small condo in the $1.5 million range. And we want to do that for a handful of years while we're getting established in our career and figuring some things out. And then maybe we'll buy our dream home later on, which is fine. And for a household of this profile, $1.5 million, they could probably do through physician specific product, a 5% down mortgage. So we're going to assume for our purposes that that's what they're doing. So if they buy $1.5 million house, it's a $75,000 down payment. And we'll, if I assume a 6.5% interest rate, the part of this that I want to zoom in on, and I've got a mortgage calculator here in front of me just from Zillow.com. It's a very rudimentary tool. There's an amortization table that this calculator allows you to look at. So at first glance, this $1.5 million house with some assumptions around taxes and insurance and things is going to cost just over $10,000 a month. So right off the bat, they're going from $5,500 a month to $10,000 a month. You might say, Justin, I get it. It's more, but like I'm building equity. I have the opportunity for price appreciation. I can sell it and make money. Plus, every time I pay the mortgage, it's like putting money in the bank. That is the conventional wisdom. However, once you zoom in on this $10,662 payment and see where is this money really going every month, especially if we're only thinking in the 3 to 5 year time frame, I want to be in the condo and then I'm going to upsize. This is where it gets really interesting. The amortization schedule allows you to see this. And what we see is that the interest payment on that $10,600 mortgage payment, the interest is $7,700. In addition, there's taxes, there's insurance, and that is all money essentially that's lit on fire. The money that's actually building equity on a $10,000 mortgage payment is $1,200. That's the principal pay down. So every month, it's $1,200. So after a year, you've paid $10,000 for a year, it's 120 grand. After that year, it's 1,200 times 12. So call it $15,000 of principal that you've built. You paid 120, you built $15,000 of principal. That means there's $105,000 that you have lit on fire, assuming that your property value doesn't change, $105,000. So now you can see why I think this is a strong opinion of mine. I often push back when people say, I don't like wasting money on rent. It's like, well, if you don't like wasting money on, you don't like wasting $5,500 of money on rent, you're going to like it even less when you're wasting $9,000 per month on taxes, interest, and insurance, something you're not going to get back. You're not building wealth with, you're just living. And that's about where the break-even point is. If you think about $105,000 of cost spread out over 12 months, that's just north of $8,500 a month. So this is actually a useful exercise as well, because what I told this client who was paying $5,500 and they wanted a nicer place, I'd say, listen, give yourself more budget. Because if you buy $1.5 million place, it's the same as lighting on fire $8,500 a month. And then the rest does build equity. But if you can rent a place for $7,000 a month and then save everything else above and beyond that, you can actually pay $1,500 more than you're paying right now. You go from $5,500 to get a nice place for $7,000 or $7,500. And you're still actually saving more money than if you bought a $1.5 million place that didn't meaningfully appreciate over time. And this is particularly helpful, again, with these short-term decisions, these like 3 to 5 year timeframes. Don't underestimate the value of renting. And I'm just talking about the mortgage right now. There's all these other benefits of, like, you know, you don't have to deal with water leaks and you can just walk away from it when it comes time to take that new job, et cetera. But before making this decision and before, quote unquote, throwing away money on rent is like, has been happening for too long and we just got to make a buy. Look at the amortization table. Look at the 30 years, the 360 payments you're going to make. Figure out for each payment, each time I pay $10,600, wouldn't you want to know if only 1,200 of the 10,600 was going to go towards equity? You're not actually building much equity, even though the payment is really high. So that's a good myth to dispel in your own mind as you're thinking about this decision, and perhaps it'll make renting look a little more attractive. Thanks for tuning in this week. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and we'll be back again in 7 days. Talk to you soon. If you liked what you heard this week, head on over to apmsuccess.com, where you can find more content and free resources to help you build a successful career in anesthesia and pain management. If you wanted to leave a review in iTunes, I'd also really appreciate it. Thanks for using some of your valuable time to join me today on APM Success.